This is Jan Swift, and you're listening to Discover Lafayette, a podcast dedicated to the people and rich culture of Lafayette, the gateway to South Louisiana. I'd like to thank our sponsors who make our podcast possible. We tape our podcast with the ongoing support of Raider and Jason Sikora, our sound engineer. Raider is a hands-on IT service provider that integrates all of your needs for advanced technical support, effective communication options, and cybersecurity. Raider's motto is, you just want it to work, we understand. Please visit RaiderSolutions.com for more information. Iberia Bank and First Horizon, who are now one bank. Two relationship-driven banks, both leaders in the industry, have officially joined forces. The combination of Iberia Bank and First Horizon creates a leading financial services company dedicated to enriching the lives of their clients, associates, and their communities. I'd also like to thank Lafayette General Health, who has joined the Ochsner Health family and is now Ochsner Lafayette General. As one health system, Ochsner Lafayette General will provide expanded services and enhanced care from the familiar faces you already trust. Ochsner Lafayette General means more resources to help solve healthcare's toughest problems, reinvesting in our communities, and being further committed to health and wellness. Ochsner Lafayette General. Together means more. Learn more today at togethermeansmore.org. Our guest today is Mike Frugier, founder and owner of Frugier Seafood, Frugier Aqua Farms, and Frugier Spirits. Mike is a rice and crawfish farmer, along with his brother Mark, and he descends from a long line of rice farmers in Acadia Parish. In 2017, he launched J.T. Melick Distillers, which makes fine Louisiana spirits derived from rice. Mike Frugier grew up in Branch, Louisiana, on his family rice farm, founded by his great-great-uncle, John J.T. Melick, who started growing Providence-style rice in 1896. Mike and his brother Mark were among the first to add live crawfish to flooded rice fields in Acadiana. What started out as a hobby on 20 acres of flooded rice fields is now a thriving rice and crawfish farm that has grown to roughly 4,000 acres. He has a great story to tell, one which not only captures the tenacity of our Louisiana farmers, but also one of an entrepreneurial spirit, which has led him to continue to evolve his farming operations to eke out all he can from the land. Today, we'll celebrate that precious food commodity, which our culture revolves around, rice. Mike Frugier, welcome to Discover Lafayette.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, what an honor. And I want to say, before we get started, when I was approached about this interview, I didn't get our connections, but our two daughters, Mia and Taylor, went to the academy out in Grand Coteau. So we had a connection that putting together. So
that was a great place. So
wonderful.
We enjoyed that time there.
Wonderful.
Absolutely.
I haven't seen Mia in quite a while, but have fond memories of all their days in sports together.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So let's get started. You grew up in Acadia Parish, and your family, they're rice farmers. So yeah. Would you talk about that growing up?
Sure. Born and raised right in the middle of nowhere in Branch, Louisiana. There's a highway that sort of splits our farm in half. That's Highway 35. And as a child, I have kind of a crazy memory, but my brother and I used to literally lay on the highway and wait for a car to come by, so there was no traffic. You know, things are a little bit different now.
Yeah.
You wouldn't try that today, but we're about 9 miles north of Rain. North
I know
of
where
the
Branch
interstate.
Is. I so, did an interview AMI Kids. I know there's a farm out there that also helps young men that, you know, looking to better their life after some bad choices. But it's beautiful land.
You know, once you grow up in the country, you're sort of always drawn to it. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're from Louisiana, you're sort of drawn to our culture. I've lived other places and traveled a lot. We're quite unique.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. So it started with great uncle, J.T. Melick. So he was the original rice farmer?
Yeah, so John Melick, my great-great uncle, there were, I think, seven siblings, five of them settled in Branch. The other two, I think, were married and went different directions, but they literally migrated to Louisiana from the Midwest right after the Civil War. There was a lot of people that did that back then. There were sort of land promoters that promoted cheap land and come down here and the land of milk and honey type of thing.
Right.
And they were attracted to the land prices, I assume. It's my understanding it took them 2 years to get here. They came by covered wagon. So back in those days, you traveled, you stopped somewhere, grew a crop, packed it in a wagon, moved on as far as you could, you know.
1896.
Yeah, 1896 is when he, when we estimate that he grew the first Providence-style rice. He grew that on some bottom land that was always wet, so rice was a perfect candidate for that. Providence-style rice was where you depended on Mother Nature to provide the water. So it was just a style of farming. It was, you know, fairly common from Beaumont through the prairie of South Louisiana. A lot of people did it that way.
And that was his main occupation. He was a farmer. Well,
but he wasn't primarily a rice farmer. You know, farming back then was sort of, you did everything. It was subsistence all the way through a cash crop. And they were from the Midwest, so they originally were highland, what we call highland farmers. They were trying to grow corn and beans and all those sorts of things, grow type crops. That didn't work very well down here. And many people realize, you know, that was the birth of the rice industry, really, if you follow the history of the rice industry. It started around the turn of the century and you know, became a commercial crop, you know, through the Depression and everything.
So when you were a young boy, did you envision yourself being a farmer, or were you thinking, I'm going to college, I'm going to see what the world has to offer?
You know, my brother always knew he would be a farmer. As a child, we all knew he would be a farmer. And his son, you can tell he wants to be a farmer. Myself, I don't know what I wanted to be a pilot. You know, I know that has nothing to do with this story today, but I am a pilot, but I wanted to go and see the world and be a pilot. But as I've, you know, grown older and matured, you know, I love the farm. I love being out there. I love being part of it. You know, it's something about the land, you know. I can't describe it. If you're not part of it, you sound crazy trying to tell the story. But, you know, that's kind of what led me to J.T. Millett, because we're trying to – people say, why did you start it? I started it for the next generation. Trying to bring a spirit to market, you know, and build a brand, that's a very daunting proposition.
And I want to back up before we get into that, because it is the main part of our story. But you first branched out, you know, a pun on words there. But back in the 80s, you were one of the first to see about aquaculture. And I've done another interview with another crawfish farmer. And from what I understand, you can't just rice farm constantly. The land needs... Like, you can't make it just on that, and also somehow crawfish came into this. If you can talk about that, what was determined in the 80s?
Well, in the 80s, there weren't many crawfish farmers. Crawfish farming, if you will, was not considered an occupation. It was there were a few people starting to get into it, but most people were doing it as a hobby or just something on the side. It wasn't a significant industry like it is today. It was just getting started. It had been building probably since the 60s, but we were certainly one of the first rice farms to sort of convert to 100% crawfish farming, meaning that we were all in trying to grow it as a crop, trying to make a living from it. There were, you know, five or six of us in our neighborhood that were doing the same thing. I wasn't the first by any means, but we were definitely pioneers in that.
Can you explain why that's a good fit for a rice farm to look at? How does that work on the land?
Well, when you grow a crop, any crop, doesn't matter what it is, most farmers know or realize that it's just not a good practice to try to go back to back to back, you know, on the same piece of ground. You'll wear it out, or your returns will start to drop. Your crops just won't be as good. So a rotation is usually done. And in South Louisiana, the rotation prior to crawfish was soybeans. It had been for probably 20 or 30 years. And there's still a lot of that done today, but it's not a perfect fit. We have very wet weather, not very good for soybeans. So there, if you're a soybean farmer, you can get rained out,
yeah.
You know, and it can be a disaster. So,
and there's very little room for error, I'm sure,
from year
to year. Very little
room for error. You got to be really good at it. Mm-hmm. And some people are. We just found the crawfish to be a much better fit.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know, it was an experiment really at the time, but over, you know, the course of the last 30 years, it's obviously
right.
Just about everybody's converted to crawfish. If you're a rice farmer and you're not a crawfish farmer, you're a very rare person.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when you got into crawfish farming, it isn't just growing the crawfish. I mean, there's distribution and other things. So this led your family, your business,
right,
to have to learn that industry also, right, for distribution and sales.
Correct. So, you know, my brother and I were just getting started. We're in our 20s, you know. Crawfish farming is not what it is today. They weren't as valuable as they are today. So it was difficult with the size and scale that were, I should say, for us both to make a living from it. So I literally got in my pickup truck and drove to Texas. I went to Dallas and began a route selling our crawfish to restaurants over there. And back then, literally, I was the first guy to show up with crawfish in Dallas. Nobody.
You would just load up ice and crawfish and off you go?
Literally. I was that naive, you know.
I guess they were live. Were you just bringing?
Yeah, they were live. I mean, I went there. I had a couple of contacts. I made a sales trip, if you will.
That's a haul.
Found five or six places that would talk to me, and mm-hmm. I taught them what to do with it, how to do it. We found some oyster bars and, you know, this was 1989. Many of the Cajun restaurants that are there today, none of the Cajun restaurants that are there today were there at that time. So we sort of grew with the market. We educated the market. Mm-hmm. And, I had hedged my bet, I guess you will. The crawfish were very popular in Houston, mm-hmm. primarily because of the oil field. People brought it with them. And it's a matter of time. It'll get popular in Dallas. So I wanted to get out in front of it instead of getting behind everybody.
Did it?
My timing was a little early.
Dallas is different, huh?
But I stuck to it. And we built a good route. And that pickup truck became Fruger Seafood Company.
Mm-hmm.
And Fruger Seafood Company now is based in Dallas. And we service all of Texas, at least all the major metro markets in Texas, Oklahoma, and Louisiana. It was kind of a regional distributor of what I call fine seafood. When I tell people I'm in the seafood business, they usually think locally. They think, you know, crabs and shrimp or something like that. But that's not our market. Our number one product is salmon.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
All the information I got, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, that's the business
that's Dallas,
sort of
though.
Supports everything,
yeah.
If you will.
That's a more upscale
market,
I would think.
A different scale to everything. That's what allows us to dream a little bit with the spirits.
And hedge your bets, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Correct.
So you really have branched out.
Yeah.
I was given all this information, and people listening, they probably laughed hearing this, but this is news. But that makes me love the story because you probably have double, triple MBAs at this point. You've had to learn as you've gone.
Yeah, they're all through experience and hard knocks.
Yeah, sweat, equity, and real equity too. I can imagine.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's a family business, though. You don't have? Do you have other? Did you have to go out and get investors, if I may ask, or is this still a family-owned business?
No, so far I've been very persistent, very mm-hmm. tenacious. I haven't gone out and gotten investors. That's a whole nother story if you care to hear it. But I came of age in the business world in the 80s, and I was in the oil field. And anybody who knows about that time knows what happened.
Yeah.
You can't describe that to a young person. You know, even though the oil field's in big-time trouble right now, Lafayette is not in big-time trouble. At that time in the 80s when the oil field crashed, I would venture to say 20% of the population literally left town.
Yeah.
And it sort of scarred me as a young person. You know, I never wanted to borrow any money. You know, if that
makes
sense.
Because that's what pulled the rug out from under people. They were leveraged.
Yeah, it just sort of.
Yeah.
And so we've, knock on wood, we've, we do borrow money. I don't mean to say that we don't take risks, but we've been very conservative, and our risks are very calculated, and we try to grow the business, step by step. And
you can make your own decisions.
If a business person is listening to that, and they'd probably say, well, why would he ever go into fresh fish, which is probably one of the riskiest things you can ever do? And that's just, I was just naive enough to try it. I didn't know any better.
And you're still doing it.
And we're still doing it.
Yeah.
You know, that was extremely difficult to figure out, but we got it done. So.
Right. Yeah. I'd like to take a break before we get into J.T. Mellick distilling and look back at another Louisiana entrepreneurial story. And this is one, Mike, about the iconic Camellia brand beans, which I know you're familiar with, being a rice farmer. In 2019, we interviewed Vince Hayward of Camellia Beans, and he spoke of the love he has for his family business, which began in the U.S. in 1850 when his great-great-great-grandfather, Sawyer Hayward, relocated from Bermuda to New Orleans to expand their trade capacity, and they began selling beans in bulk. Let's take a listen.
As you came up, though, as a young man, did you see yourself working in the company? Was that just sort of expected with this multi-generational family-owned company?
It was something I wanted. Definitely was not something that was expected or even pushed. Mm-hmm. And, I don't know. I mean, I've always had the entrepreneur bone in me. And, it was something that I always admired and knew, even as a young child, that it was a very special part of who we are as a family.
And what an opportunity for
you. Huge.
Yeah.
I mean, I just feel so grateful to be able to do what I do. Just because of the lives that we affect in a positive way.
Well, we've had a guest on before with another, not as long back as Camellia Beans, but I remember Popey Bio. We're here with Jason Sikora, multi-generation family-owned business, and it's very rare to see those survive, especially past the second and third. It's really unusual. And so for your family
really
now.
Trying really hard not to screw it up.
Oh, well. Yeah. It looks like things are going pretty well.
Yeah. Welcome back to Discover Lafayette with Mike Frugie. So Mike, when I had Joelle Politsky and Jan Risher reached out to me, I did not know the story of your distillery, J.T. Mellick, and we have a bottle of vodka sitting here that I know you're very proud of. It's got a beautiful design by your wife, Courtney, but you are now in the distilling business, and I didn't realize that vodka could be made from rice. So I know you've got a story behind this. If you can jump in any way you want to tell it, because I know the vodka was like a learning curve for you.
Sure.
Yeah.
So we didn't know it could be made from rice either. my family's had a family business since the 1800s. You know, they were started off very simple, but it's continued. And four generations, you know, when you really sit down and start thinking about that, that's a long time. And I was successful. I have been successful in my business and, you know, I literally am sitting around saying, how do you pass this on? You know, what's it going to look like? And I'm a thinker. That's what I do. I think all the time, sometimes too much. But I've been asking the question probably for 10 or 15 years, how do I add value to the rice crop? Because, if you're a farmer and you're not thinking about innovation, then you're probably not going to farm much longer. That's just the realities of it. It might be, I don't know, if you analyze farming, they get bigger and bigger. Farms get bigger, and there are fewer and fewer farmers. So, we were sitting around and brainstorming, and, somebody said, I wonder if you can make vodka out of this. I don't know why it came up, but it came up. And
what did you think?
I don't know what I thought. There's many factors that kind of come to play that sort of brought all that together, and that, you know, we could talk for hours of why that came to be, but it just sort of, it all came to a point at that particular discussion, and I said, I'm going to find out. I literally turned to my computer and I started, you know, Googling things and started looking things up, and I was really just trying to find out what, being a farmer, being a producer, I was like, what's the conversion rate? That's what I'm thinking.
How much?
I'm a fish producer, so we think in terms of yields. What's the yield, you know? So I wanted to know how much rice was literally in a bottle, and that's what I thought was important. It turns out that what's in the bottle is not what's important. It's the marketing that really is the real factor to being successful, but that's, we can get into that a little later. Yeah. But the, my whole motivation was to try to find out how and what the numbers were. And I, turns out there's, you know, there's this whole craft industry out there that focuses on craft distilling, and there's several conventions that, you know, you can attend if you like. And it just so happened there was one, it was going to be in 6 weeks, and I signed up for it. That was in 2017. And
to make vodka or just to make spirits?
Just to make spirits. Mm-hmm. It's like the particular, you know, it's like a, you know, it's a convention, you know, where they have conferences and people speaking and telling you how to do it and giving you advice and all this sort of thing. And just like there is in any other industry. And I went and I attended and I kept asking people, you know, how do you make rice? And people kept saying, never heard of that. Don't know anybody who's ever done
nobody
that.
Makes nobody knows vodka how to do it.
I don't have no idea. Kept hearing that over and over. And then I attended some of the marketing forums and they were all saying, you need to be special. You need to be different. Make sure you're different. It's very competitive. And I said, well, nobody's ever heard about rice and I need to be different. So, you know, literally I said, I'm going to go and try to make some. And I found some distillers with some experience, and we started working together, and we collaborated, and it probably took us 6 months to, you know, sort of perfect the recipe.
Can you just talk about what do you do? Like, how much you put rice in a vat? Like, how do you start?
Yeah, sure. The process is fairly simple. All distilleries are very similar. They take a grain and they cook it and they convert the starch that is in all grains to a sugar. And once you do that, you end up with what is called a mash, and you cook it in a giant kettle, and that's typically called a mash tun. But, you know, depending on the volume you're doing, you could cook it on a stovetop if you wanted to.
What kind of volume were you guys doing at first?
Our typical ferment is 1,000 gallons.
Wow.
That's fairly large by craft standards, but fairly small by, you know, say like a Maker's Mark or somebody like that. They might have a 20,000 gallon ferment or something. You know, some of the huge vodka, you know, giant producers might have 100,000 gallon ferments. It gets fairly large. But we cook the grain and we basically make a beer. The process for making beer, whether I make it as a distiller or a brewery makes it, is almost identical. The ingredients are different. And so, therefore, the flavor is different. And that's what makes everything unique. Once we make that beer, then we sort of divert from a brewery. And we then take that beer and we distill it. We separate the water from the alcohol. And that is the base spirit. Depending on what you're making, if you're making a vodka, then you... There's several other steps through filtration purifying it and whatnot, and finally getting it into a bottle that is kind of difficult to explain without, you know,
pictures,
showing it to someone. But the process is fairly similar. What makes each spirit unique is the grain and the yeast and the process and the recipe that you employ to make that original beer. you know, that's the primary thing that makes it different.
Is it brown when you call it beer? Is the cooked, it's still a clear, like a white
in
rice
our,
look?
Like if you're making a corn whiskey, the beer might be yellow, foamy yellow in color and texture. Mm-hmm. If you've ever been to some of the listeners may have been to a bourbon facility, and the mash is sort of, it's hard to describe, but maybe it looks like foamy ice cream, you know. And ours is not quite as yellow. It's more mm-hmm. of a, looks like a heavy cream.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's what it looks like in the ferment tank.
Right. That's what I had read, that at first you were looking at making more of a whiskey. Are you still working on that? Do you still look at making something besides vodka?
We are, you know, I think I'm making whiskey, let me put it that mm-hmm. way. Whiskey is a much longer mm-hmm. Proposition in terms of time. We are making a whiskey. We're making a rice-based whiskey. It's primarily mostly rice. There's some other ingredients in it that are sort of part of our recipe that, you know, we wouldn't publish, if you will. But I set out making a whiskey, and like many craft distilleries, almost all of them make a vodka because of the time element. You mm-hmm. can make vodka in about 30 days. You can have it in a bottle, and you can have it in the marketplace. And most people try to make a vodka to get some cash flow while they make their main products. But because a vodka or a gin are so easy to make, if you will, there's a lot of it. It's very, very, very uh-huh. competitive. And so I didn't think that would be our main product. But it turns out that our vodka is so good, and it's really, really, really good. And, mm-hmm. and that's not just me saying that.
I've
and
seen
we didn't
the reviews.
Expect that.
Yeah, hmm? People say it compares yeah, to the highest end vodkas and taste tests.
We've done blind taste tests against everybody.
Yeah.
And we do very, very well, if not win most of the time. In fact, almost nobody knows this because of COVID, but that same show that I attended the first year in 2020, we entered our vodka into that show, and we won all three categories that you could possibly win. We won double gold, which is the best you can get for any spirit you submit. We won best in category and best in class. I'm not sure which one of those ranks the highest, but it's as good as you can do.
It's a great start.
You know, and this is going head up against all the craft mm-hmm. brands in the country. You know, so there's some, you know, it's not just me saying it's good. Mm-hmm. We actually have the medals to prove it, so to speak.
Is it, you think rice is just a clean, I don't know how to describe that, but is it because it's so clean that it just distills better than other vodkas, perhaps?
You know, it's, I don't mean to, I don't often take credit for things, but there's something that I did in our recipe that's different, and I was pretty sure it was going to work because I cook a lot, and I know what tastes good, if that makes sense. And I had a hunch. It was just a hunch, and we tried it, and it's in the bottle. You know, it turned out to be mm-hmm. that because there's other people that have done rice vodka, and their product did not come out the same. They're no longer being produced because it wasn't very tasty,
yeah.
if you will.
Like moonshine or something, huh?
I think ours is, I think, you know, I think we got some... Uh-huh. We have legs, as they say.
I was going to ask, are there others around the country that are in business? Are you an outlier?
There's no, you know, significant commercially successful rice-based spirit in America. There are several craft distilleries that are making product out of rice. They sort of come and go. Mm-hmm. To my knowledge, there's really no rice whiskey on the planet. And that's kind of a scary proposition for me because I'm making so much of it and storing so much of it. I keep thinking, well, you know, there's a reason for that, mm-hmm. and I just haven't found it yet. but on the other hand, the reason I think there is none is because of the timing of Prohibition. And in Asia, they make a lot of spirits out of rice, but they don't primarily make whiskey there. Japan makes a very fine whiskey, but it's primarily on the profile of a Scotch, because that just happens to be what caught on. And everywhere else in the country, in the world, people made product with what they had available. Most of the, if you trace the roots of American whiskey, it comes from Scotland. So the Scotch came here. They started employing their practices to make whiskey out of the local grains, and the climate was different and the grains were different, so they ended up with a different product, but it all sort of traces its roots back to Scotland. Prior to Prohibition, there were 10,000 distilleries in America.
Wow.
People don't, you know, realize that. I don't know how many there are today. There's probably 3,000 or 4,000 active ones, I'm guessing. But after Prohibition, there were only like 3 or 4. Yeah, and
they've continued, I guess.
And those have continued. But prior to Prohibition, all of those small distilleries were primarily farms, just like me. You know, the farmer took his leftover grain and he distilled it, or she, the family, whatever. They distilled it as a way of preserving their wealth. And not their wealth, that's a bad word, preserving the grain.
Well, it's like canning, like you're just preserving what you
grew. Yeah, so they grew the crop, they ate as much as they could, they fed the rest of the animals, and whatever was left over, they distilled it just as a way of preserving it, and then they would trade with that spirit. People started, you know, we could sit here for hours talking about the history, but regardless, if you look at the history of when rice started being produced, it became a commercial crop right as Prohibition came to be. So my guess, and it's totally just a guess, is that it just never got started because there was no product available.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
How long will this last? Like a bottle of vodka, what is the shelf life for that?
Oh,
do you know? Like, would that be years. Good?
Maybe forever. Uh-huh. And it's alcohol is shelf stable. I don't know. We'd have to get with a chemist to find out.
Though,
but it's 100 years. I don't know. I'm guessing. I really don't know.
Yeah. And what is most vodka made from? What?
Vodka can be made from any form of sugar. Any form of starch can be converted into a sugar. So
it's like the Russians.
So, you know, I don't know what the first. There's debates on who made the first vodka, but it was probably either wheat or potatoes.
That's right.
One or the other. Uh-huh. And it depends on who you talk to and which opinion you get. But it can be made from table sugar. You know, it can be made from vodka at its essence is called a quote-unquote a neutral grain spirit. And so you've basically distilled it to its purest form. If that makes sense. And
this is so crystal clear in the bottle. It's
you could
beautiful.
Take any beer in the grocery store could be distilled into a vodka, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
As long as you have alcohol in the liquid, if you run it through a distillation product and you purify it enough to get to 190 proof, that's the definition of neutral grain is 190 proof, and that is vodka, if you will. Uh-huh. Now, we take that 190 proof and we add back purified water to get it to 80 proof before we put it in a bottle.
I see. You mentioned early in the interview that you learned that marketing is really what's important as much as the product, if not more. So would you talk about that? I know I mentioned that Courtney Frugier, your wife, designed the beautiful label, but how do you crack into the stores? Are you on the shelves of different liquor stores? Like, talk
so,
about the marketing,
you know,
please.
We went to market in 2018, not really knowing what we were doing, just sort of learning.
Like you did with the crawfish.
Just like we did with the crawfish, yeah, exactly. But we did have we had 30 years of experience selling door-to-door, if you will. So we literally went door-to-door to all the grocery stores and started telling our story. And our distributor helped a lot, But we are now, you know, in our region, we're in virtually every grocery store, every liquor store in Acadiana that we're aware of. If there's one out there that we're not in, you know, we hope people will let us know and we'll definitely get it to them.
Right.
We're not as strong in New Orleans. We're just now starting to really focus on that area. A lot of mistakes that people make, they try to go too far, too fast, and then you sort of lose your ability to support yourself. And so we're really focused locally to really do very well here, and then we'll gradually and you know, we've been very patient. You know, we didn't plan on COVID, or we would be further along. COVID sort of, it didn't stop us, but it definitely had us in a holding pattern, if you will. But marketing, you know, if I was, you know, talking about spirits in general, anybody can make a spirit. Not everybody can make a great spirit, and almost very few can actually go and create a successful brand. And I haven't done it yet. Mm-hmm. Even though we're successful locally, we have to be successful far beyond just a local community, you know, to be considered a successful brand. We could even, you know, that'll take years to make that happen. I don't have an unlimited budget to just go buy market space, if you will. But the good news is we have a great tasting product. So marketing is the hardest part, but I don't think you can be successful marketing without a good product.
Mm-hmm. So. And the good thing about it is it doesn't spoil like the crawfish would or,
absolutely,
you know, your crops. I mean, you've got a good product.
That's not a small thing. Mm-hmm. When I considered, you know, the distillery, we definitely considered that we would not want to be in another sort of hyper short shelf life product. Crawfish have a short shelf life.
Salmon.
Of about 2 days. You know, fresh fish is maybe 2 weeks, you know, but this stuff is stable for generations, possibly, you know.
Is your hope that you're talking about being a fourth generation, which is very unusual, Mike, to get past second and third generation is very unusual. So where you are is unique. But to see your family continue this, are you hoping that this will be like a stronghold for them to look at for growing the family business?
Yeah, that's quite honestly, that's why I started it. You know, I think it's going to take longer than my sort of working lifetime, not my lifetime, hopefully, but my working lifetime to get it where it needs to be. Now, whether my kids or who wants to take on, maybe some of our people want to take it on, I'm not sure where we're going to go from here. I mean, I've got a ways to go before I'm getting out of the business, but so I've still got plenty of energy, and I'll see this through for quite a while. But that was the whole reason for starting the brand. I wanted to be able to own a brand. It didn't matter what brand. I just wanted to be able to own a brand. You know, everything we have done, my family since the beginning, we're a commodity. So when you're a commodity, the market tells you how valuable you are. And you have to take what the market tells you. When you build a brand, you don't get to just sort of set your price, but you can enhance your value beyond just the what's in the bottle price, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. What I like about it is it's so unique. It not only promotes our culture. You know, rice is such an important part of South Louisiana and beyond, but it's so unique. I'm sure worldwide, you know, it's a unique product. And I love this, that I'm so glad to share your story, because I don't know that a lot of people know about it. They might see it on the shelf and not even realize what it is that they're buying, well, you know, the story behind it.
There you go. That's all part of that marketing that I was talking about.
I know.
So you know, it takes a long time to not only tell the story, but figure out how to tell the story. I think we're very fortunate coming to market at this time in the history of the world, in that we have social media available to us. So it affords us an opportunity to build a market. that we couldn't otherwise afford to do. Mm-hmm. If we were just going, you know, if we were trying to do this 30 years ago, I don't know if you could do it. Because you couldn't pay for the advertising.
You'd be driving your truck.
Yeah, I'd be driving my truck. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Trying to sell it in Dallas.
Yeah.
Do you know what this retails for? I know you wholesale it, but what size is this bottle? Like,
this is a 750 milliliter bottle. Okay. That's your standard fifth, if you will.
Okay.
A fifth is literally one of five in a gallon. That's why they call it a fifth. So five of these make a gallon. That's how that came to be. There's two other sizes that are, you know, popular, a 1 liter bottle and a 1.75, which is a, what your typical people call it, a handle. We don't do those sizes yet. We only do the 750. Mm-hmm. We'll eventually bring those to market. But that 750 retails for, it depends on the retailer, but between less than $25 a bottle.
So it's affordable. Yeah.
$24.99 to $22.99. Mm-hmm. Every once in a while, you'll see it on sale for $19.99. We're not trying to be the, you know, we don't want to be a cheap vodka for sure. And I don't, we're really a very great value because I think we contend with any of the really, really high end vodkas in the market. I don't want to say I'm a cheap version of them because I'm not cheap. I'm just local. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's an amazing product. That I drank martinis before I ever even envisioned J.T. Millick or vodka or making it from rice. So I was, you know, I drank all kinds of different vodkas. And I like to drink a martini. Not a lot of them because they're very potent. But I consider myself a guy who likes to drink vodka, and I appreciate great tasting vodka. And you know, when we started this, we were running through a bunch of different recipes with the people that were helping me develop this, and we were in this big argument over which version to go with. And one guy said one thing, and finally, it just sort of, you know, he says, "Well, how do you drink your vodka?" And I said, "I drink it in a martini," thinking that, I don't know what I was thinking. We said, well, let's go make one.
With olives? Like, how do you drink it? How do you fix yours?
What I call a dusty martini. So I, you know, 2 ounces of vodka in over ice in a shaker, and then just a teaspoon of fresh olive juice, not mm-hmm. old olive juice that's been in the refrigerator too long, shaken very hard, very aggressively. Pour that into a glass that's been sort of swirled with vermouth, dry vermouth. And, you know, you pour some in the frozen glass and you swirl it around and you dump it out. Or I may just put a teaspoon over the ice and then pour it in.
So it has to taste good to be
And so, yeah,
crisp,
you're just getting the pure vodka. Our vodka can be drinking neat, honestly, just ice cold, neat. You can drink it over ice. It's perfect. I just like to physically hold it in, you know, in a martini glass. I drink it straight up. So in the fancy, you know, martini glass with two olives, that's my favorite way of drinking mm-hmm. it. And
I have one more question. Do you use stuffed olives? My husband used to always like anchovy stuffed olives. He would. Do you have a certain kind that works?
No, I'm you know, haven't gone that far in my experimentation, but I just use not a super large, but what they call a queen olive. Mm-hmm. You know, again, olives need to be fresh. You know, people might you know, if the olives sit in the refrigerator for too long, the vinegar or whatever they're stored in starts to get really dark and it takes on a different flavor. And so that's might seem like a small thing, but it's critical to that that taste.
This is interesting.
And the vermouth, by the way, people don't realize this, but they'll buy a bottle of vermouth. Your vermouth needs to be refrigerated.
Oh.
If you don't, it's a wine. It will go bad and it will go flat.
And you'll see that just sitting at people's bars.
You'll see it. People leave it out all the time. They just think it lasts forever and it mm-hmm. doesn't. So the vermouth needs to be fresh. The olive juice needs to be fresh. And it's just melts in your mouth. It's amazing.
Yeah. I wish people could see your face. We're not videotaping. We're just audio taping. But you obviously love what you're doing. And it's so, to me, so rewarding to let people hear that voice, because you're growing your business in ways probably no one would have ever dreamed of, Mike.
I have to be honest, this is a lot of fun. It's a lot of work. It's going to take a long time, but everybody loves it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when whether you're selling rice or you're selling crawfish or you're selling fish, sooner or later, I hate to say this, but it ends up in an argument with someone, because you're selling to restaurants or grocery stores or whoever, and it's a commodity and something didn't show up, or it was late, or it was this or that. And not everybody's upset, don't get me wrong, but like right now, I'm in my crawfish life, it's Mardi Gras, and Mardi Gras is next week, and we are dead short on crawfish. So it doesn't matter who I talk to, they're all mad. Mm-hmm. You know, they're mad at me, and this happens about once every 5 years, mm-hmm. that you don't have enough crawfish for Mardi Gras. And no one understands that. And I've been doing this for 30 years. It just happens.
Right.
You know, we didn't do it.
I didn't even think to ask you about the crawfish. Mm-hmm. Are they looking good this season?
Well, they are if we can get some normal warmer weather.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't been super cold, but it's been in the 50s since before Christmas. And when you have that sort of steady average low temperature for a long period of time, the water stays cold and the animals don't grow. And so, you end up being short. And so, but anyway, back to the vodka.
Enough about that.
Everybody thinks it's cool. Everybody thinks it's amazing. And it's fun to tell the story.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I almost never have people upset. You mm-hmm. know, the product tastes great. I mean, in a lot of ways, we're selling fun, you know.
Yeah.
I mean,
Local fun. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, Mike, as we wind down our interview, looking at the bottle, I did want to have you just mention you briefly to help all of us. You got into distributing, or I guess bottling and distributing sanitizers. And
yeah.
that is
yeah,
not
sure
easy,
did.
Is it? That's not an easy task. But I know you put your this on hold for a while. You're
we
distilling
did.
To help people get enough sanitizer on the market.
So, you know, last year, and we're coming up on that same time frame here in about 4 more weeks, on the 16th of March was sort of D-Day for us on our seafood company, our crawfish company, everything. We literally went from normal business on a Friday to completely 100% shut down. You know, 65 employees idled, if you will, by that Tuesday. And that remained that way for about 2 weeks. And during that 2 weeks, you know, we didn't know what was happening. We thought the end of the world was coming because all of our customers were closed. Our customers are restaurants. And, I didn't know how bad it was going to get. But I kept getting these emails through our industry groups, if you will. You know, we're part of all these different groups that support the distilling industry, and people started taking their high-proof spirit and converting it to a sanitizer, and they were giving it away, and they would put it in little tiny bottles, you know, at their checkout or whatever, and people were snapping them up, and I just started getting all these phone calls, and then, you know, I was kind of watching this happen, and I'm thinking, oh, what are we gonna, you know, I was really worried about my other businesses and wasn't really paying super attention to the sanitizer. But then locally, I guess that caught on and people started calling, like, mm-hmm. when can you get it? How can you get it? How can I get some? I need to get some. And it, we, you know, took all the product that we had available to us and we converted it to little 6 ounce bottles. And, it was, you know,
that's a lot of work.
It was this really strange, surreal experience because we shipped out, I don't know, like 10 pallets of this stuff. And we thought we were like helping the community and really doing a good deed. And all we did was throw blood in the water everybody needed so much more, if that
I
makes
see.
Sense.
Yeah. It was like the crawfish. It wasn't
they
enough.
Needed a lot. And it was like, how we.
And that was all your vodka product?
It was all our vodka, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
We immediately realized, you know, this is a big deal. We need to gear up, if you will. And we did, and we converted everything we had and brought in the extra labor and, you know, just sort of redirected all the people that we could. We couldn't redirect our Dallas people to this, but many people on our farm we redirected. And instead of putting it in 6-ounce bottles, we started packing it in gallon jugs. And, you know, we probably made, I don't know, 100,000 gallons of this stuff before it sort of looked like we met the demand. I mean, I didn't want to convert my business and go into the sanitizer business. That wasn't my intention. It was just a way to help the community, way to get the product out there fast. We had to buy other base spirit. We couldn't make it all ourselves. Some of it made out of corn, and it was kind of a running joke in the office. Is that the corn stuff or the rice stuff? Because the corn
you don't
want to
mix it up.
Well, no, but the corn has a distinct odor to it, and my wife hates it, so she's always, which one is that, you know?
You have to make it at a 70. What is it that to make it where it sanitizes effectively? Is it a 70 proof?
Yeah, don't quote me on the recipe because I've forgotten it since then, but it's basically 60 or 70% pure alcohol. Purified water. Mm-hmm. And then you add hydrogen peroxide. The purpose of the hydrogen peroxide is just to keep people from drinking it. Otherwise,
it'd be like the vodka.
Yeah. Right. Ugh. And then you add some other products to thicken it up a little bit. Uh-huh. And, we packed it in gallon jugs. And, you know, that was really what kind of saved my sanity during the initial 2 or 3 months of the beginning of the pandemic, because otherwise I don't know what I'd done, because it was pretty bleak.
Yeah.
But
I'm curious, were you able to sell your crawfish product later in the spring?
You know, the rest of the story on the pandemic is oddly enough, crawfish was probably our, other than hand sanitizer, our best-selling product during the middle of the pandemic. I guess people are going to get their crawfish fix no matter what. Mm-hmm. So many of our customers converted to takeout, and they started selling not live crawfish, but boiled crawfish to go. Now, locally in Lafayette, everybody does that, and it's quite common, but it's not common in the Metroplex of Texas. But most people converted to that, and so we were able to virtually sell all our crawfish on the farm as if it were a normal year. We did not sell all of our regular seafood products normally, because many of our customers were, you know, pretty devastated by being shut down. But, you know, Texas bounced back quickly, as it usually does. So did Louisiana. This year, we're not 100% back where we were. We're probably about 60 or 70%, but that's way better than zero, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah.
And I'm looking forward to kind of by this summer, maybe getting back to normal, mm-hmm. I hope.
Right. Mike Frigier, I want to thank you for sharing your story. Was there anything that we didn't bring up that you wanted to get in, or do you think we covered
what you were tell you about the bottle, you know, and
yeah, talk
you know,
about that as that, we want
there's
to.
A kind of an interesting story. My wife is a graphic artist, and mm-hmm. she's helped us with all of our artwork since the beginning. You know, she's been instrumental in all of my businesses in one way or another. And we actually hired an agency to help us with this bottle. And they have a lot of influence on the bottle, because I didn't want something that looked homemade. I wanted it to be perfect, or as near as we could get to that. And they came down. They were from out of state. Actually, they're from a whole nother country, but that's kind of irrelevant. The point is, they came down and, you know, they really put a lot of energy into it, but they just didn't quite get the culture. Mm-hmm. They didn't get who we are, and they kept presenting things that were just not quite right. And, I'm kind of known in our meetings, I'll like reach a point where, you know, we're not getting it done, and I know I want it done, and I'm starting to get frustrated with these people because they're wanting to finish the project. They want to wrap it up, you know, and I'm getting frustrated because I'm not satisfied with the product yet. And my wife is the calm one of the two of us, I guess you could say. She's the person who's always happy and very optimistic. And she says, you know, you need to calm down, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, you think you can do any better? literally that weekend, she designed that label.
Was it different than what they were, the other team?
Yeah, it was totally different. Uh-huh. But she, you know, she had the advantage of knowing me. You know, that if you notice the bottle, it has the crawfish on there. There's mm-hmm. rice stalks in the background.
Providence Distiller.
You know, the way it says Louisiana bold out mm-hmm. in front is across there. Those are all elements that I wanted in the label.
Right under your nose.
What's that?
Talent right under your nose. And there, you didn't.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. We could not have accomplished this without the help mm-hmm. of that agency. They did a fantastic job of really refining it. But the essence of the label, she did that. Uh-huh. So
it's beautiful.
Great job.
Yeah. So when people go to the stores, they can look for J.T. Mellick Distillers, Louisiana Handcrafted Rice Vodka. And it's beautiful. It'd be hard to miss this on the shelf. Yeah. So I want to wish you the best of luck in this endeavor as you grow your company. And I'm sure in the next few years we'll be hearing about something else, Mike. It sounds like you're a work in progress with growing your company.
We've got the whiskey coming out soon, probably a year or so from now. Maybe we'll talk about that someday.
Yeah. Well, thank you all for listening to us, too. You can find Mike's interview at discoverlafayette.net, or even better, you can subscribe on your mobile device or iPad, whatever you use, wherever you get your podcast. You can find Discover Lafayette. I'd also like to thank our generous sponsors, Iberi Bank, which is now a part of First Horizon, and Ochsner Lafayette General. Thank you for your ongoing support. And of course, Raider and Jason Sikora, who makes our podcast sound much better than me just taping it by myself. Thank you, Jason, for all you do. On behalf of Discover Lafayette, this is Jan Swift.